Got great ideas, but no idea how to build a website? Get Bluehost. Their AI design tool creates high-quality WordPress sites super fast. Whether you're a blogger, influencer, or launching a side hustle, Bluehost helps boost your growth with built-in marketing and e-commerce tools. Upgrade to cloud to get 100% uptime and 24/7 security to stay online all the time. Why wait? You've got the vision. Make it real. Visit Bluehost.com to get started.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Welcome to another edition of Pollock and Thurston. John Pollock of Post Wrestling, along with Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics. We have a very busy show today. There is a lot that is happening on the legal front. We're going to try and break it down as best we can and making sense of both the amended complaint that came down Friday night. Nothing like a Friday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, 101-page filing that Brandon was instantly alerted to. And we will be also getting into the ruling this past weekend from the Maryland Supreme Court regarding the Child Victims Act and why that is so pertinent to the Ring Boy lawsuit. And I have to state that when I was alerted about this from my co-host, I was very surprised that we were getting this ruling just kind of out of nowhere, because the window was a very wide one, that this was going to be ruled upon sometime before August. And it certainly fell into those parameters. And boom, a 4-3 vote in favor of upholding the Child Victims Act of 2023. So maybe we start there, Brandon. Why is this important to the Ring Boy lawsuit?
Because, so this, as you said, this is about a new law, a 2023 law that the state, the General Assembly, as I believe is what you call the Maryland State Legislature, they passed a new law in 2023 that said there's no more statute of limitations for civil lawsuits when it comes to suing either perpetrators or non-perpetrator defendants that you say are negligent. You can sue them with no time limit. Up until then, there had been a 2017 law that allowed you to sue basically by that you had until you turned age 38. So you had 20 years after you became 18. That was the 2017 law. The 2023 law changed that and said no more time limits whatsoever, basically. And the Supreme Court of Maryland, not the Supreme Court of the United States, had to test this. There are a number of situations and legal cases that this naturally affects, including involving schools and the Catholic Church, et cetera. So this was tested in state Supreme Court. And their argument, the defendants who were saying this is a violation of the state constitution, were saying that the 2017 law gave us something called a statute of repose. And I have learned what a statute of repose is. A statute of repose is basically, it's a, what they call a vested right that you no longer ever have to worry about being sued. Nobody can reverse this. Nobody can take it away. That's what was at issue. The Supreme Court ruled 4-3. So a narrow decision, but ruled that no, even though it did say in the text of the 2017 law, this is a statute of repose. The Supreme Court decided that, well, it's not really functioning like a statute of repose. Even though you call it a rocket ship, it's still a chair. It's a chair because it works like a chair. It functions like a chair. It's not a statute of repose. It's a statute of limitations. Therefore, and this is the Supreme Court's, this is the justice's ruling, that it is actually just a statute of limitations, which means it can be taken away by a 2023 law. And therefore it is. And of course, all these plaintiffs still have to prove their case in their own court cases, but there's no way to get out of this by saying it's unconstitutional.
So if we look at this, if this vote had gone the other way, it would not have been a situation where you cannot bring a suit forward. There's just a cutoff date of when that person becomes 38 years of age.
Ring Boys were all teenagers in the 80s. They're probably in their 50s or something like that. They're all well over 38 years old.
Exactly. So in essence, had this vote gone the other way, it pretty much would have killed the Ring Boy lawsuit, which was filed in Baltimore County. And it was specific because of this Child Victims Act that allowed this window to be opened. If you look back to the Rita Chatterton case, there was a narrow window that was opened up in New York where you could file. And thus there was a settlement with Vince McMahon over Rita Chatterton. That window has since closed. So it wouldn't have been a case where, like, there was a limited amount of time that you had to file a lawsuit.
Right. And the Ring Boys, I if it's not in the filing, I'm pretty confident that they allege that they were abused in various states, but they also allege that they were abused in Maryland. So this works with the Child Victims Act of 2023. The other states just don't have this removal of statute limitations like Maryland has enacted in recent years.
So the report, which is nearly 500 pages, some nice reading if you're on a vacation. It includes details about more than 150 Catholic priests and others associated with the Archdiocese of Baltimore abusing over 600 children. Days after the new law was to take effect on October 1st, 2023, the Archdiocese filed for bankruptcy to protect its assets ahead of an anticipated deluge of litigation. So obviously this goes much wider than just simply the Ring Boy lawsuit specific to Maryland. And the law firm that is representing the five John Does, and more on that in a second, they did put out a press release, including a statement from their attorney, Greg Gutzler, who his statement included, "The Supreme Court in Maryland's decision upholding the Maryland Child Victims Act, effectively eliminating any statute of limitations on child sex abuse lawsuits, is the right one, and we hope other states will follow Maryland's lead." Goes on to state that survivors of sexual assault, especially children, often do not come forward for years or even decades after the abuse occurred. This delayed disclosure happens for numerous reasons: shame, fear, or manipulation, and it has too often prevented survivors from ever seeking justice and getting accountability. It also has allowed perpetrators to continue hurting countless innocent people. My clients' lives were destroyed by the defendants who allowed and enabled the open, rampant sexual abuse to occur for years. The abuse inflicted on my clients was inexcusable. They were mere children and had the right to expect that WWE executives would take action to protect them from the predators working within the WWE. We will bring light to their truth and fight for accountability and justice. And a point that I have not seen kind of as focused upon, but is very significant, is that since this filing was made in October, additional plaintiffs have joined the case. And I've reached out to
unclear what joined means. If they're actually going to be plaintiffs or if they're going to be involved in some other capacity.
Well, I have asked like what the number is, and we have certainly heard privately of like figures out there, but nothing confirmed. But I think that is significant there, is that additional victims have come forward as well. And in the press release, it also includes that the FBI previously identified at least 10 Ring Boys abused by Mel Phillips, but there are likely countless others who have suffered in silence for decades.
Yes. And we should catch people up, I suppose, if they don't already know. So this is involving allegations from the 1980s that former ring announcer Mel Phillips abused various ring boys who were helping out with the ring crew and other errands. And WWE is allegedly allegedly negligent in allowing this to happen. And Vince and Linda McMahon are both named defendants as well.
So this puts things to the forefront of this case, which is was temporarily sidebarred once it was paused in December. And we were thinking like this could be months before this ruling comes out. So now this is back in the forefront, and it's hard not to acknowledge the timing of all of this, not to say one had to do with the other, but the reality is with this case now proceeding forward, Linda McMahon could be days away from her Senate confirmation hearings. And while I do not think this is necessarily going to curtail her confirmation, it does bring this to the forefront that she is.
It could come up. Yeah.
It could certainly come up. And this does become a story that gets focused upon on a political landscape, that with all of these issues surrounding various nominees for various cabinet positions, you do have one of your nominees that is named in a sex trafficking lawsuit as a defendant. Yeah.
So Donald Trump, the president, has nominated Linda McMahon to be Secretary of Education. he's talked about wanting to shut down the Department of Education, which is the entity that she would be overseeing. She's nominated. She still has no Senate hearing date. So the Senate has to confirm, just like they have for all the other cabinet positions that have been in the news, that the Senate would have a hearing with her where she would be asked all sorts of questions, probably adversarial questions by Democratic senators of the committee that's related to this, and probably nicer questions by the Republicans. And then eventually there would be a vote. And I don't know that she's necessarily not going to get confirmed, but it could be the case that this Ring Boy lawsuit comes up, because you can imagine how it would be pertinent to overseeing an education department where you're overseeing the education of millions of children.
And it is also worth noting that we have various representatives of the various defendants. Laura Brevetti of the infamous steroid distribution trial of 30 years ago is representing Linda McMahon. We have Jessica Rosenberg, who is representing Vince McMahon in both this case as well as the Janelle Grant suit. And of course, WWE also named as a defendant in this case. And it becomes the obvious.
Represented by Paul Weiss, and they're being represented by one Daniel Toll, who's also the attorney representing WWE in the Janelle Grant case as well. I believe I'll check on that, but I believe that's the case.
So I guess the immediate focus will be upon the, yes. First of all, I'm very curious if we are going to get like a confirmation of the numbers of Ring Boys, if there are, you know, since October, like what new information has come to the plaintiff side. We have certainly reached out regarding potentially hearing from their legal representation, and as well, if this sort of intensifies the efforts of the defendants to ultimately settle this case, because you would think that that is probably now a much more pressing issue than it was a week ago.
Yeah, I think it's very possible that we could see this complaint amended. If they do have more Ring Boys who have more accusations of abuse who are going to join this lawsuit, I very much believe that they would have to amend this lawsuit. We would be reading yet another amended complaint related to this case instead of the Grant case. Because they would have to be added to the lawsuit. They would have to raise their own allegations, just as we have the five Ring Boys allegations in the complaint that exists. So that's something we could be seeing in the near future. They might amend their complaint. I've been thinking about this, the jurisdiction here. Let's get it real exciting. Is that, you know, this lawsuit was originally filed by the plaintiffs in state court. The defendants moved it, or at least are attempting to move it to federal court. I don't think that there's a great argument to get it back to state court, given that I don't believe any of these parties are residents or citizens of Maryland. Everybody lives out of state, including the company, including Vince and Linda. So it seems like it makes sense for this to remain in federal court, but that's something that could be litigated. It could be an amendment, as I mentioned. And then I would think eventually we're going to get some motions to dismiss from the defendants.
Yes. On that note, we will, shift focus a bit to the other lawsuit that WWE is facing. And as we mentioned, on Friday night, the amended complaint was filed on behalf of Janelle Grant, a 101-page filing. And this was, you know, in essence, this was an expanded version of the complaint from last year. It had a lot more specifics. There were a lot more names involved. There were more text exchanges, the transcript of a voicemail from Vince McMahon, with the argument that this NDA was signed under duress, and trying to strengthen that argument, being that if they can prove that this was signed under duress, that could throw the NDA out. Not to mention the fact that there are allegations of abuse that occurred after the NDA was signed as well. And the reason this is a key portion of this complaint is that is what they are trying to prove here, is that this NDA is not enforceable given the circumstances of which it was signed upon, because that is going to be the decision for Sarah Russell, who is the judge overseeing this, that has to make that decision. But there's a lot to unpack here from this 101-page complaint, including the official reveal of multiple names, several of which we had reported upon last year.
Brock Lesnar was already known to be the person referred to as WWE superstar when this story broke, when the lawsuit was first filed. He was anonymized under that pseudonym WWE superstar. the description of him as a former WWE and UFC champion made it pretty clear there are very, very few people who could be other than Brock Lesnar. But nonetheless,
I think Cain Velasquez was saying, not me. Okay.
Yes. Yes. He has his own legal issues to worry about. But the Wall Street Journal reported that I believe they used some sort of background sourcing to say that, yes, this is Brock Lesnar. That was when the story broke a year ago. The four corporate officers who are not accused of abuse, not accused of being involved in the trafficking, but are accused of being negligent and accused of enabling Vince. Those were reported by our report with Tim Marchman last year in March for Front Office Sports. And those are Nick Khan, Stephanie McMahon, Brad Blum, and Brian Nurse. We knew who those people were, but now they've actually put their names in the complaint. Rich Herring is another one. Again, not somebody who's allegedly involved in abuse or trafficking, but somebody who Grant interacted with a lot at work. He is the Warrior Award recipient. He's retired now, but I believe he was shown on screen for the Netflix Raw premiere. So those people are all named. What we have are a lot of additional details that, you know, further.
Before you go on there, you want to explain just the way it is outlined is that we got kind of two versions of this complaint, one of which Stephanie McMahon's name was listed, and then in the complaint that a lot of people read, she was still anonymized as corporate officer number three, referred to just as she in various instances in this complaint. I mean, we were talking about this on Friday night on Rewind to SmackDown, and I mean, it's a question for their side of why there was that discrepancy, but there, it was notable that the fact that in the complaint, she was listed as corporate officer number three while the others were identified.
Yeah. So I'll say at the front, when we reported on this in March, Ann Callis, who's the attorney for Janelle Grant, confirms to us all four of those identities, including Stephanie McMahon. So it's kind of a moot point. I have asked Grant's representatives if this was an error, what the deal is. They didn't have an answer for me. To look at the original complaint, there, Stephanie McMahon is anonymized as corporate officer number three at various points, but you wouldn't know who it was, but you also had them referencing in the original complaint, some of Stephanie McMahon's public statements that they felt were pertinent to their complaint. So she is referred to by name, just referring to her public statements that are already public. But then we have in the amended complaint, if I can put this on screen, they've actually crossed out her name and replaced it with W corporate officer number three. So I don't know if that's just an error. They sort of transposed with, you know, replacing the pseudonyms with the real names. I have no doubt that that's who they're referring to, is they're referring to Stephanie McMahon by corporate officer number three.
It's a question for them, but as Brandon mentioned, it really is a moot point when we have an on the record confirmation from Ann Callis that corporate officer number three is Stephanie McMahon, as you as well see in writing there. So, I mean, that's, for whatever reason, that was the only distinction.
And just to briefly add some detail of what is alleged, Grant is alleging that these executives at a minimum knew about the relationship between someone who started out as an entry level employee and the CEO and chairman of the company.
Yeah, some of the descriptions in this amended complaint include Vince McMahon treating Ms. Grant as a commodity, offering her to other men. In March of 2020, McMahon began sharing sexually explicit photographs and videos of Ms. Grant, including pornographic content he recorded on his cell phone with other men, both inside and outside the company, including with members of the television production tech team, executives, producers, and a world-famous athlete and former UFC heavyweight champion Brock Lesnar, with whom WWE was actively trying to sign to a new contract and ultimately did sign that contract. This was a new name that was, again, not a defendant in this suit, but included, listed in the complaint is Michael Hayes, who is the only person that is listed besides Brock Lesnar as receiving this pornographic content, as well as the allegation that it was distributed to members of the crew, but Michael Hayes is the only one being specifically named here.
Yeah. And as the original complaint does, we have additional screenshots of text messages to support these claims to say that, yes, these messages and these images were shared. We have a screenshot that is now included in the amended complaint, which is censored, as people can see you're watching a video. There's a big block over what is presumably Janelle Grant. But there's this overlay text on the image saying, "Dear Vince's crew, hope you're enjoying these pics." And then another that says specifically, "Hey, Michael," presumably referring to Michael Hayes. His real name's Michael Seitz, right? "Vince's stories are true, and I love to live up to the hype. So supporting the notion that Vince directed her to, she's actually sending these messages to Vince, which is clear from the screenshot. That's who these messages are being sent to, but they're sent to Vince to be shared with Michael Hayes and the writing team.
Yes. And again, this came out on Friday night. And while no update regarding like Michael Hayes or any blowback to this, Fightful did report he was there at the Royal Rumble on Saturday, but yes, it remains to be seen if there is any fallout regarding Michael Hayes or if there will be any statement on his behalf to this as well.
Yeah. And then just to draw a distinction, there were direct messages. It's alleged that there are direct interactions between Brock Lesnar and Janelle Grant. There are no allegations in the amended complaint or the original that says that Michael Hayes and Janelle Grant had direct text message content, or they were not exchanging messages, apparently. At least that's not alleged here.
Yes. Goes on to say, in January of 2022, Vince McMahon told Ms. Grant that his wife had found out about their relationship, purportedly to avoid divorce, negative publicity, and other repercussions. And despite the fact that Ms. Grant never expressed a desire to take legal action, McMahon said that Ms. Grant's time at WWE was at an end, but that he wanted her to sign an NDA to ensure her silence on, among other things, his personal misconduct. Even after pushing Ms. Grant out of the company and muzzling her with an NDA, McMahon continued efforts to exploit her, including attempting to traffic her to WWE star Brock Lesnar, who would be in New York City for a live event and TV taping in March of 2022. It also includes a text message that is imploring Janelle Grant to fly to Greenville, South Carolina, even if it's just to say hi to Brock. And so, cross-referencing this.
To see Brock, spelled with a C, the letter
C. If it's
C,
just to see Brock, yes.
Yeah.
So this would have been, to my recollection, would have been a January 3rd, 2022 edition of Raw, which would have been 2 days after the day one pay-per-view that Brock appeared on, and then Brock appeared on this episode of Raw in Greenville, South Carolina, which would have also been about a month, 4 weeks before the NDA was signed on January 28th.
Yes. And so, again, these are allegations of not only the allegation that she alleges that she was assaulted at the condo by McMahon, but this is here's she's allegedly being trafficked, after the NDA is signed.
In terms of the expansion of various text messages, we see exchanges between Janelle Grant and Vince McMahon. There's what has been a pretty widely circulated screenshot of Vince McMahon allegedly texting back and forth with Janelle Grant at a production meeting that apparently was being filmed by Netflix at the same time. And this screenshot lines up with the text photo that was included here as well. So, I mean, it does become a bit of an interesting question too about, just any potentially damning content that Netflix may have filmed here.
She's alleging that he's looking at nude photos of her at this moment when he's at this meeting, which is,
yes.
I haven't gone back and looked at the documentary, but they've included a screenshot from the documentary, presumably.
So that was included as well. There was also a series of office blueprints, and this was important because it established sort of the location of Janelle Grant in the WWE headquarters, which was their previous headquarters in Stamford, where Janelle Grant, they state with, again, this diagram of the floor plan, that she was in an office that shared a wall with Paul Levesque, with, I guess, the implication here that Paul Levesque was, he was very much in close proximity to Janelle Grant, where several of these incidents of abuse were alleged to have occurred, and that there was a door that was set up to connect Janelle Grant's office to John Laurinaitis's office as well, which was this design was overseen by Nick Khan and Brad Blum, that they include in the description too.
Yeah, I suppose the implication is that these executives should have known that it was dangerous to put her in this situation, I think is what is getting got at there. But for people watching in video, the text is pretty hard to read, but you can just barely make out. I believe it says Grant EA here for people watching in video. And then I believe it says Laurinaitis EVP. And then we have HHH EVP to give you an idea that they're showing these blueprints of the headquarters building where, you know, apparently Triple H and John Laurinaitis had offices that were right next door to each other, sharing the same wall. This is the office that Grant alleges that she was sexually assaulted in by Laurinaitis and McMahon together. This is the office that allegedly Laurinaitis, you know, told her to come into and perform oral sex for him. So this was whether or not Triple H was aware of this is sort of what I think they're getting at here without spelling it out.
Yeah. I mean, it's the first time, like, unlike the first complaint that Paul Levesque is actually, yeah, named.
His name is actually used in the complaint.
It's used. I don't view this as like this smoking gun for Paul Levesque. That does he have plausible deniability to this? I would say he will. But nonetheless, his name is listed here. And at the very least, I think you want many more questions asked about this investigation that went on in 2022, one in which that, again, they reiterate here that Janelle Grant wanted to participate in this investigation and was not questioned, which is, I mean, it is ludicrous that Janelle Grant would not have been questioned here. But was Paul Levesque questioned in this investigation? I mean, there's no transparency to what went on in 2022 regarding this investigation that the company reached out to and had a third party conduct.
And you thought they were going to file it as an SEC filing, huh? Remember that?
Yeah, there we go.
They're not publishing any of that. It would give the public a lot of reassurance. Well, it would be helpful to reassure the public if reporters and the public could read the results of that investigation. Presumably they produce some report or something like that, some materials. That would be helpful. But if, you know, as you know, I expected that has not been ever made public.
Why? Why has it not been made public?
Is it material? Apparently, they believe it is not material for investors to have to understand the value of the company.
What about that policy we're awaiting? The one that John Michaels, he had just forgotten.
We published that policy, I believe. We obtained it from sources and published it. You're talking about the consensual relationships policy, or at least that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. Where is the www.com link? Can I go?
It's not there. It is not public. But it is not public from WWE.
Understood. So there is also, and I'm curious to get kind of your understanding of this as well, is that when the NDA is signed, again, the NDA is signed January 28th, 2022, and we do get a transcript of a voice message from Vince McMahon that, in basically to recap, there seems to be like a hard date that they need to get this NDA signed. Yeah, and Vince McMahon, I believe the term that he is using is that she has the company over a barrel. And that
this is very Vince McMahon language here.
This is like the idea that this could come from any human other than Vince McMahon is preposterous. This is absolutely a Vince McMahon voice message. And that he is going to be, I think, double fucked if this does not occur, because he, like, obviously there is something imminent in terms of meeting with the with the executive wing, with the board of directors, that this NDA needs to be signed. And it's certainly, like, just from my opinion here, I mean, this would really qualify as a woman that is under duress here and being extremely pressured to sign this NDA.
Yeah, I'm not sure if duress has a special legal definition, but I'm, you know, that's clearly what they're arguing, is that the nature.
So we need to work on this really fucking fast. Otherwise, I'm double fucked. I can at least state from my non-legal opinion that she was certainly under pressure to sign this NDA. If it passes the threshold of duress, that's for a lawyer or an attorney to determine.
I will mention too, we also got in any event, as part of this transcript, which is it certainly sounds like Vince McMahon talking. As I mentioned on Saturday night, it's interesting. It's an interesting insight to me to learn that just what the dynamics were around what we've seen reported in the past of, and I think it is, you know, described in the original complaint, that there was this board of directors meeting that Vince McMahon had to disclose any ongoing litigation at. And he refers to Jerry McDivitt being involved in this and in interacting with the board's audit committee, which is like just a a combination usually of board members. And so they needed to complete this NDA, have it signed and done with, so that they could honestly say that there was no ongoing litigation. If they didn't get it done in time, then Vince McMahon, in his words, was going to be double fucked, that his, that the company would have to learn about the relationship between himself and Grant. His wife would end up learning, and this is clearly causing him a lot of stress.
Yes. So, I mean, just to read like a portion of it, if you, so he says, I'll be divorced. Aside from that, I'll be fucking, you know, I don't know what this. Okay. Well,
sorry.
That's okay. To just get back to
aside from that, I'll be.
Yeah, this is Vince McMahon speak. We can, you can probably just read the language here, but in essence, like this would certainly give credence to the idea of at least, you know, Vince McMahon trying to actively withhold this from the company, to have knowledge of this NDA having any kind of existence or that there's any, pending litigation. So I think that is, you know, in terms
it,
of trying
it points
to argue
the notion that he has awareness that he was involved in something appropriate, not only from this piece of evidence, but also from the text messages that Grant provides where he's texting her, don't talk about me in the office anymore. I know you would never do anything to hurt me, but just for the both of us, we should, you know, just don't bring my name up. Cause he's aware that it would be viewed as inappropriate if he had a relationship with a relatively low level employee, him being the CEO and director of the board.
So the NDA gets signed on January 28th. And what we do know from the original complaint is that there's another accusation of abuse at the hands of Vince McMahon after that date. There is also the attempt to traffic Janelle Grant at some point in March that year to coincide with a SmackDown taping in New York. And then at the end of March, that is when they receive the message, the board of directors do, from a friend of Janelle Grant, alerting mm-hmm. them. So that is sort of our timeline here, is when the board first finds out about this. It's the end of March 2022. And then the first Wall Street Journal story comes out in June.
And that disclosure from what's said to be a friend of Grant to the board, I believe that is where McMahon, from that moment forward, believes the NDA has been violated. He's already made the first payments by that point, but that's why I believe in his mind he doesn't make the subsequent payments on the NDA, which he is supposed to a year from then, which would be February 2023.
Yes. Yes.
And yes, because
that's the payment. That's the first payment. Yes.
He misses, and then almost a year goes by and this lawsuit gets filed.
Just the final note here is, Ms. Grant had this is going back just to her interactions and what had been set up with Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis. And there is, again, texts from Vince McMahon pretty much setting up like a schedule for Janelle Grant to meet up with John Laurinaitis and kind of just like explaining like days he wants her extended. Like, again, this is all in Vince McMahon's text exchanges with her. But Ms. Grant expressed her apprehension about the arrangement with Laurinaitis to McMahon and explicitly told him that she did not want to be alone in a room with another man. McMahon acknowledged Ms. Grant's concerns and subsequently preyed on those same apprehensions by directing her to engage in those acts. Fear, intimidation, humiliation, isolation, and the sudden emergence of Laurinaitis, Khan, and Bloom in her daily life made Ms. Grant believe that if she was not obedient to them, something bad would happen to her. She became controlled to the point that she was worn down, numb, and docile. And in addition to that, there is the again, reiterating the effects that Janelle Grant continues to experience from all of this, that she has been, dealing with severe PTSD from all of this, unable to leave her home for weeks at a time. But in essence, those, I would say, are the major points that we take from this amended complaint. And it seemed to be getting into a lot more specifics, a lot more disclosures of text messages, which, I mean, I could not speak to this authoritatively, but it would seem that Janelle Grant has maintained probably a ton of the correspondence with Vince McMahon. That if there is more, it would not be surprising to me.
Yeah, mean, we all have text messages on our phones that go, but you know, unless you delete your messages and clean it out,
we've got records. Who would do that? Because Vince McMahon apparently did that.
Yes, he says he's. What did he say? Remind me.
Well, we just know that
in your post, yeah.
Yeah, that the text, I believe the reporting was that if you had seen these texts in context,
if you had seen the other end of the conversation from her, where she's in his view, I guess he's getting at, well, she was really cooperative with this and encouraging me to do all these things, is probably his view.
Yes. So from the end of this is a very quick response that we did get from Jessica Rosenberg, the lawyer for Vince McMahon, on Friday night. And we can pull that statement up. But in essence, I mean, it felt like a pretty standard response. As expected, the proposed amended complaint is nothing more than the latest publicity stunt in an ongoing smear campaign. It is filled with desperate falsehoods from a team that continues to disregard the law and the truth. Which I thought was just, first of all, this was like a very bare bones statement that does not address anything that is brought up here. And at the very least, there are text messages here. Like there is irrefutable evidence here that at the very least was direction and correspondence from Vince McMahon. This is not specific about anything. Other than general falsehoods. So I wouldn't say that this statement really addressed anything in this particular complaint, but perhaps by design it is to be just simply try and, you know, denounce the complaint. And that was that.
Yeah. And just to set where everyone else is in terms of the defendants, John Laurinaitis has denied any wrongdoing, although he did originally say that he was a victim of Vince McMahon as well before sort of going back on that. He seems to have flipped and then flipped back, and he is in line with Vince McMahon. And he is a defendant in this. His attorney has basically filed, I believe, what were called rejoinders to the WWE attorneys and to Vince's attorneys, who are, you know, putting the motion for a compelling arbitration, which we can get to in a moment too. So it looks like his attorney isn't having to do as much work, as the WWE and the Vince attorneys are. And WWE has denied that the executives, including Nick Khan, had any awareness that there was any abuse that they have denied. And they deny that there is this conversation between Vince and Nick, where supposedly, according to Grant, which is an account from Vince to her, that they discuss whether or not they could trust Grant.
So again, we go back to the same follow-up as we had from the first complaint. Ultimately, this comes down to Judge Sarah F. Russell determining if this NDA is enforceable or not, if this will go to arbitration, if this will go to trial, and like there is no time frame on when this decision comes down.
Well, now that we have an amended complaint, the arbitration motions will be refiled, probably in very similar version as they just were a few weeks ago. And there will be a decision. That is the main issue. Arbitration is where you go to private mediation. It's out of public court, and this dispute perhaps gets settled that way. I do think that the fact that there is alleged abuse here happening after the execution of this NDA might complicate things. And that's something to watch for. And I believe we have in here just exactly the part of the NDA that I've been referring to without actually reading from it, where it says, let's see here. I had it up.
For those curious, if you do want to track down this filing, it contains the NDA involving Vince McMahon and Janelle Grant. Like, you can read the entire NDA here.
Yeah. Well, I've lost my place here on what it, maybe it's right here. Where to start here? It's whether known or unknown, asserted or unasserted, which she, I guess I've lost it. Sorry. But basically my point is that it doesn't cover just indefinitely into the future. It doesn't cover keeping secret any events indefinitely in the future. You signed this on January 28, 2022. She's alleging that abuse happened after that, which this NDA might not cover.
If there's any other points you want to make, I think we should also talk just briefly about this this Fox Sports lawsuit as well that was filed just over the past week as well. Because, again, while not accused of any wrongdoing, Nick Khan's name popped up in two lawsuits over the past week, in addition to this amended complaint from Janelle Grant. So at Fox Sports, Charlie Dixon, who's a Fox Sports executive, there were two lawsuits filed against him. One by Nooshin Faraji, who is a former hairstylist at Fox Sports, who alleges she was groped at a coworker's party by Dixon in January of 2017. A separate lawsuit was filed by Julie Stewart Binks, who alleges that Dixon asked her to his hotel room after a work meeting in January of 2016, pushed her against the wall, pinning her arms and forcibly kissing her. And the connection here is that Nick Khan, who was the representative for Charlie Dixon, was working at CAA at the time, and Stewart Binks met with Khan in 2015, and Khan directed her to fire her agent at the time because her agent was not on Jamie, that being Jamie Horowitz, or Charlie Dixon's team. Again, Khan is not accused of any wrongdoing, but this was a client of
his name is mentioned.
Yeah. His name is mentioned, and Charlie Dixon at the time was a client of Nick Khan's.
And it mentions that he was the agent for Jamie Horowitz, too, who went on to be fired from Fox Sports for sexual harassment allegations, and then was subsequently hired by Nick Khan, or at least soon after Nick Khan became the president of WWE. He was hired by WWE to be an EVP of development and digital. So it does mention Nick Khan, and as you said, it mentions this conversation between the plaintiff and Nick Khan. The connection, I think, to draw here is, look, there's a lot of sexual harassment and other sexual misconduct allegations happening in the sports media world, which is a world that where Nick Khan represented many famous sports media figures and apparently executives too, which was not something I was really aware of. This is not on-air talent, Charlie Dixon and Jamie Horowitz. Yeah. These are executives at Fox Sports. Apparently he was representing them too.
Yeah, which is, just a different subject matter if he would be, representing both executives and talent as well. Like it does show you kind of that dynamic as well. But
and I think the thing to tie together here is you have the Lee Fitting hiring in 2024, which happens actually just a few weeks before the Janelle Grant lawsuit is filed. But by then, the Wall Street Journal stories exposing the NDAs has already come out. They decide under Nick Khan's leadership to hire Lee Fitting. Despite the fact that he's been released, it's not a public story yet, but he has been fired from ESPN under sudden and suspicious circumstances that would lead one to question why he was suddenly let go after some 19 years or whatever it was at ESPN. Raises the
overseeing their most valuable properties as well.
College game day, yeah. But I think it raises the question about Nick Khan's tolerance of issues like sexual harassment, particularly in light of the allegations and investigations that W had been through. Nonetheless, he was comfortable hiring Lee Fitting. He has been associated with a lot of people, at least a culture, at least where there's a lot of sexual misconduct allegations coming out of.
Yeah. And I think, listen, like Nick Khan is obviously like very, he's a very savvy, very smart individual. And I think if you listen to his interview with Bill Simmons in early 2023 and his reaction to Vince McMahon's return to the company, I think it gives you some of that insight. While at the same time, he is not going to say anything disparaging about Vince McMahon in public, especially when Vince McMahon was back in power at that particular time. But, that particular answer, I think, is one that you can circle back to. And, to paraphrase, it was, when these things happen, you go away for a time. That's what the public likes. And then you come back. And that was what Vince McMahon did. And no one should have ever believed that he was actually retiring last summer.
And he
said, though, the board of directors was very much of the belief that we think you should stay retired.
And for what it's worth, we're talking about comments that he made right after Vince had forced his way back into the company. So he had already resigned for the first time by that point. The Janelle Grant lawsuit is not out at that point, though. And he's saying things like you just referred to. And he's also saying, I applaud him for coming back in the way that he did and so forth. I think it's a it's a fascinating interview too, to look back on, to get some sense of what kind of values he has and what kind of principles, because we get so little along those lines, but to hear him talk about Vince and the exit that he had, surrounding some four NDAs that were secret up until 2022.
Well, corporate officer number three was all over Royal Rumble weekend, Stephanie McMahon, who has no position, no title that we are aware of with WWE. However, she was sent out onto the Pat McAfee show on Friday, promoting the Royal Rumble, but also promoting her new project, which is going to be Stephanie's Places, that will be launching on ESPN Plus. And who is producing this series, Brandon?
Peyton Manning's company, Omaha Productions.
Correct.
Omaha Studios, what do you call it?
Omaha Productions. And who is the president and co-founder of Omaha Productions?
Is Lee Fitting involved in that? Or I think Mike Mansuri was also involved in that?
The correct answer would be Jamie Horowitz.
Jamie Horowitz. Okay, there we go. It all connects.
So there you go.
Jamie Horowitz, by the way, is no longer working for WWE. He was
no.
He exited around the time of the merger, just after.
So the closest we got in this interview to any of these allegations against her father, against the company, was briefly referenced. And here is Stephanie McMahon's answer in a broad sense towards criticism or any of these allegations.
How has it been to not take it personal, all the pop shots or all the shots that have been taken at you, your family, everything? Do you try to stay above it? Do you try to stay away from it? Do you try not to see it? How do you kind of engage in all that type of stuff?
So it's been my whole life. And when I was in high school was when my dad was indicted by the federal government. And the media came after my family in a really big and really hard way to deal with when we were in high school. And I think at that time I was filled with a lot of anger, and resentment. And I had a hard time, you know, navigating all of that. And I think, you know, now in my later years when all of it seems to happen again, it's, you know, with a little bit of reverence that I can appreciate all of it, because it's just noise. You know, people have opinions no matter what, and that's great. And you can think you know exactly what's going on. You can give whatever dirt you think you know. But at the end of the day, you know, I know where I stand, and that's how I have to just be grounded and rooted in who I am and what I believe in, and try to ignore the noise.
Sometimes answers are
follow-up to that.
We were moving on. We had Stephanie's Places. Okay. I can't recall what the follow-up was, but there wasn't anything regarding a follow-up to that. First of all, there is no one that tap dances better than Pat McAfee when it comes to this. What's it like, the pot shots that are out there? Take that as whatever you want, just throwing it out there. Or with Hulk Hogan, as he was on the show this past Monday, and Pat McAfee clearly wanting to get into the racist comments, but was not going to call it out like that. And Hulk Hogan was not taking the bait either. I digress. But I found it interesting in an answer like that, as much as what is not said, what is implied, as very indicative of her thoughts on this. And listen, I do not doubt that the steroid distribution trial was an absolutely traumatic event for Stephanie McMahon. And I think that all, came out in that post 9/11 edition of SmackDown, where she famously compared
9/11 for her. Yeah.
She famously compared 9/11 to, I know what you're going through, because the company, my father was under attack. So, I mean, it really does give you an insight there into Vince McMahon and Stephanie McMahon both. I can't speak to this level with Shane or Linda, but to those two, this idea of being persecuted, and holding on to that is, I think, very much alive in both father and daughter there. But I mean, in such a way that, I mean, this is just noise. It's not like we have concrete, like, complaints, allegations, texts, videos. Not to say she is going to conduct a trial on the Pat McAfee show, but it is interesting just to hear her insight.
To parse this so much, but did you get the sense that she was hinting that she had overreacted to how how big her feelings were about the steroid trial.
I did take that. And I have always not been as negative to, like, let's remember when 9/11 occurs, it's a horrible comparison. And she, you know, rightly received a ton of criticism for it. That said, she was like 23, 24 at this time. I give a lot of leeway to somebody that is just, you know, that is something that in her world, that steroid distribution trial and being in the courtroom as her father was just excoriated at various points. I would hope that she has matured from like that kind of worldview in 2001 to see the difference between the two. And I did take a bit of that from this answer that I don't think you would have, like, this never should have aired in 2001, to be quite honest. But I mean, that was, 24 years ago. I would hope that she has, can look back on that and see the gulf of difference between a trial, of her father, who it was never denied that there was a massive, steroid usage, under her father's, purview of this company versus, you know, an international tragic event, that was 9/11.
Because at this point, the timing of her two resignations, the first one temporary, the second one permanent, those coinciding with just before the first one happening after the board knows she's on the board, after the board knows about the NDA scandal, and she temporarily resigns at that point. And then Vince eventually resigns. She becomes the co-CEO and the chairwoman of the board. And then Vince forces his way back into the company. And then she resigns days later. It points to friction between those two. You combine that with, you know, her happy declaration that this is the Paul Levesque era and so forth at WrestleMania last year, into that too.
And the Paul Levesque era will continue at WrestleMania this coming year with his Hall of Fame induction. But it was an interesting answer, regardless, from Stephanie McMahon, and probably one of the only time she's even going to, you know, even parse the issues that are going on, and almost doing it in almost a, like, you know, and it's all happening again. You know, wild.
Well, there was no indictment this time, at least not yet.
Not yet. All right. Let's talk before we wrap things up. The Royal Rumble went down this past Saturday, if you are not aware, and this was legitimately one of the most successful events in company history. And are we going to have an attendance dispute the level of WrestleMania 3? Maybe not. But instead of the company versus reporting, this is the company. This is Paul Levesque versus production, because we had quite the dispute on Royal Rumble night, Brandon, regarding the attendance. 70,342 versus 65,470. And where are we going to land on the famous Royal Rumble 2025 attendance at Lucas Oil Stadium?
I get the sense that most of the time, thanks to WrestleTix, they do feel pressured to be more honest with their attendance. I think they are including suites. Maybe that was just the difference between the numbers that they were attributing to suites versus without suites. In any case, those ticket prices are real high, and we've got a gate that they've called the third biggest gate in WWE history, which means that it's just under the WrestleMania gates. Well, it's under the two WrestleMania gates of last year. But it also means that it's greater than the $17.3 million gate of WrestleMania 32 in 2016, which for a long time, for the last several years, that had been the biggest single event gate in pro wrestling history. They surpassed that mark this past Saturday. So it's somewhere in the 17 million mark, I would say. So it's less than 17.7 million without fees. It's more than 17.3 million with fees. You do the math. It's a lot of money.
I liked how we pivoted from Saturday night, Michael Cole calling it the third highest gate ever, to Monday's press release, the largest gate for any single night event in WWE history.
Which I guess is their way of saying, WrestleMania is a 2-day event, so that's special, even though
the gate is broken into two nights.
Yeah.
I know. It's WWE math for you, but a tremendously successful event on the same day that TKO hauled in a $20 million site fee to stage a fight night card in Riyadh. So not a bad day's business for.
Have you seen we have ratings for Royal Rumble? Did you notice that?
Ratings for the Royal Rumble.
Are you not aware of this?
Okay. The viewership stats or other?
Yes. We have a 2-day measurement of the global viewership on Netflix, which of course doesn't include US because Royal Rumble still airs on Peacock in the US, not on Netflix. But for what this means with no context, 2.1 million views. So that means 2.1 million accounts viewed this show's entire duration on average. I've already confused people. Regardless, it did, you know, just under what Raw does, which is in the US, which is 2.9 for this past week. Some people watched it. A lot of people watched it. I don't know. That's my takeaway.
Yeah. I mean, when the fact is you're taking away the largest market in the US and this is only a 2-day aggregation of stats. I mean, this ranked in the top 10 in 27 countries. It listed. This was
the 10th most watched thing on Netflix. Despite this is so complicated now, right? Like, despite the fact that it's only in 2 days of this window, so it's probably not going to rank in the following week. But yeah, despite only having 2 days to accumulate viewership, but most of it's going to be live or soon after live.
Yeah, I would honestly think that for Raw, yes, it is a 7-day figure that they are taking into account. I would imagine that 75% of that is within the first 48 hours. I would imagine it's a huge concentration into those first 24 to 48 hours that people are watching this, if not higher. So, yes, Raw for the fourth week in a row, did 2.9 million global views, for this show, which was the go home edition going into Royal Rumble. And, this ranked, it seems that we are at least getting consistency of like where it is ranking in the top 10 with Mexico, Canada, but to me the untapped market is Bolivia. Okay, if NXT
you
is
know
going
what I
anywhere
about all these countries where they rank highly is which hemisphere are they in?
It is a great point that this is very much concentrated to a very in sync geographical region where the time zone is going to be more.
And I think it has been ranking somewhat well, right, in the UK too, right? Like it's hit their top 10. But I think, you know, we're seeing all these South America markets that we've never really thought of as major WWE markets, but they're also, it's just more convenient in terms of timing for them to watch it live.
Yeah. It is a key component where live viewership you would think is really propelling, this, at least in terms of the international markets as well. Just going back to the Royal Rumble, we did have all of their percentage breakdowns. My favorite being that 100% of the matches were sponsored on Saturday night. 4 match sponsorships, Brandon.
Sponsorships.
So. It's almost like they write out all the stats and then they get onto like an AI bot and be like, dress this up as much as possible. 100% of the matches were sponsored. Yes, we had stats for social, merchandise, viewership, and of course, the gate. And then you have to decipher. It was a very, very successful event. And I show Speed, the breakout star of 2025 in professional wrestling.
Yes, as well as, what's the other gentleman's name?
Kai Cenat.
Okay. Yeah, I watch him all the time.
Last story, and this was dropped during the Royal Rumble broadcast, that WWE is launching Evolve on Tubi. Will they be going to some of the old Evolve haunts that we are going to be seeing? Is Ybor City going to be back on the WWE rotation?
What, Joppa, Maryland. Yeah, I can hear Lenny Leonard saying those city names.
Oh, if Lenny Leonard was brought back for this, I think that would really take this to the next level. But
yeah, you're going to need commentators.
Absolutely, they will. Lenny Leonard would be a fantastic addition to this. But this is going to be overseen by Gabe Sapolsky and will be premiering on March the 5th, which is what night of the week?
What night is best, is the most clear of wrestling, would you say? It's like Sunday or Thursday, maybe?
No. You know what? You know what's a wide open lane?
What's that?
Wednesday at 8 Eastern. That's where I would put this. And wouldn't you know it, that's what Tubi agreed with. And well, that
it is less competitive than it used to be, I'll say.
It is less competitive than it used to be. My non-reporting theory here is that there is a greater emphasis on we are making the narrative out there. It is no longer a WWE versus AEW discussion point. It is we are going to lessen it that people are going to be more focused on AEW versus TNA, AEW versus Evolve. Like we are going to downgrade AEW in people's
minds. It was mind. AEW versus NXT to start with.
AEW versus NXT. I think that is going to be what is more so
the compare them to our developmental. Yeah.
That's what they are. The discussion point will be geared towards, even though this is not something
we're not going to get data on.
We're not so getting data for this. I mean, that's very.
Do people know evident. What Tubi is? Like, can you watch Tubi in Canada?
I had to look this up. I was able to sign up for a free Tubi account, no VPN required. So to my knowledge, yeah, there's no geo restriction in Canada. So this is a fast service. And this is
for anybody who doesn't know it, there's no subscription fee required. It's just ad supported. Anybody can log in and watch some stuff on Tubi and watch the ads that come with it. It's a Fox. What do we have here? Kai Cenat is credited with coining the word Riz. Oh, which is short for charisma, I've heard.
Oh, I thought it was short for the Rizzler.
I can't confirm that.
Okay.
But Tubi, now remember, Tubi is a Fox fast channel or fast platform, and which stands for free ad supported television. And remember, it was Tubi that sort of out of a potential deal between Tubi and MLW spun the MLW antitrust lawsuit where allegedly WWE intervened, allegedly involving Stephanie McMahon making a phone call to executives at Fox and or Tubi to get them to stop and cancel this deal just before it was to be announced between MLW and Tubi.
So to bring everyone's scorecard up to date, Raw on Monday nights for 2.5 hours, NXT on Tuesday nights for 2 hours, Dynamite on Wednesday night with whatever length this Evolve streaming show is going to be on Wednesday nights, 2 hours of Impact on Thursdays, 3 hours of SmackDown on Fridays, at least until the end of May, 1 PLE per month on a Saturday with the occasional Saturday night's main event sprinkled in on the same night that Collision airs, and beginning a week from Sunday, 3 hour block of WWE on A&E programming.
But look at the bright side. There's no more Rampage.
Rampage is the one casualty in this expansion of professional wrestling content. And that is it.
Tubi is available in the US, Canada, Mexico, Latin America, which their map only indicates like Panama. And I think this is Ecuador,
the new hotbed for WWE,
UK and Australia. So, a lot of big markets there. Who's going to do the reviews for Evolve, on post wrestling?
We are nominating Brandon Thurston to be our official Evolve correspondent. It is also worth noting that this past week, Fox held its earnings and did announce that it will be launching its first direct-to-consumer.
Did they talk about Evolve? Did Lachlan Murdoch talk about how excited he is to work with Gabe Sapolsky?
You know what? I did not hear them. We're back in the WWE business was not mentioned. However, it is interesting. Like this is... You know, this is technically in business with Fox.
Yeah, right. And that got rid of SmackDown. Yeah.
That did get rid of SmackDown. And I mean, at least was, you know, at least this theory of a shockwave show, like Fox was the outlet that was linked to a shockwave event. And not to say that this would be an exclusive that they have, but to me, it is not.
You would think the antitrust lawsuit would and UFC's antitrust issues would dissuade them from pushing for an exclusivity clause as part of this deal, but who knows?
To me, if you're WWE, it's the best of both worlds that they don't have to push for exclusivity. But if you're Fox, it's like, we're already working with WWE. We're less incentivized to add an alternative wrestling program to our laneway when we have WWE. Like that would be who I'm knocking. If I want 2 more hours at a reduced rate, I'm looking at WWE now first instead of looking at their competitor. Like, I don't think you need this exclusivity if you are WWE. I mean, it's more so just an indication of, you know, WWE having their programming on multiple fronts, on multiple services, and having multiple partners that are on their own volition not going to be entertaining the idea of getting into a relationship with an AEW, for instance.
Yeah. I guess I would frame it as that it's, if you're calling NXT sort of the minor league of WWE, well, this is like what, double A ball if we're talking about Evolve. It's the developmental to the developmental.
That should be the tagline. Are we going to get Jimmy Bauer calling these events potentially?
Who knows?
The pseudonym. Yeah. All right. That is everything up to date. Was there anything else you wanted to tackle on the docket today, Brandon?
I think that was all. I'm looking at the list of topics that you emailed me earlier. The Netflix.
You know what we're going to do 1 week is we are going to go through a standard SEC filing that TKO puts, and we're just going to go line by line, and we're going to break it down.
I'm in favor of that.
These statement of beneficial ownership statements. Okay, let's have the
charity stream. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that will take us to the next level.
That'll be a marathon live stream, I think.
That we will.
I can say this. So about Netflix viewership. So I've done an estimate here that assumes that we know the big global number, which was what, not 5.9 million views. 5.9 million global views for the big premiere. And we know that it, according to their video amp, that live plus same day in terms of households, it did 2.6 million. So if you take those numbers and if you just strictly assume that the viewership has declined in the US to the same rate as it has globally, then we can do an estimate that tries to reconcile the data that we know historically through Nielsen on the USA Network for Raw. And what I get when I do that estimate is a viewership set of numbers that now that it is settled into, now we have week four data. I know week five just happened, but we don't have that data yet. But through week four, we get an estimate that Raw is very much performing how it did on the USA Network, where, you know, I could say it looks like it's doing about 1.8 million viewers, somewhere in that range, which is pretty close to what it was doing. I mean, it's right in the range of what it was doing a year ago at this time on USA Network.
Well, I think that is, like, it is certainly tougher, I think, to discern this data. But
I want to apologize to everybody watching the video. This Y-axis is viewers in thousands. I apologize for not properly labeling.
Well, this is a very helpful chart, I think, that everyone should check out. And you can do so over at patreon.com/WrestleNomics, the home of the WrestleNomics report that drops each and every week from Brandon, both written and audio content for those that can't get enough of Brandon Thurston. So you can always check that out. And will we be getting any legalese in this coming week's WrestleNomics report?
No, here we're going to have another editorial discussion. I've been trying to keep the legal stuff for post, and I have written a little bit about it if we have minor updates or something like that. But it's mainly the business stuff that's on the Patreon, and it's on Substack too. The Patreon is still the best place to get all of the stuff. The WrestleNomics Report newsletter that I do every Friday, as well as you have Quarter Hours. I just published the latest Quarter Hours for Collision SmackDown, the other day. That's all out there for subscribers, as well as my reports for each and every TV show, both in terms of its TV ratings, to the extent they are available. I'm still analyzing that Netflix data for Raw, as well as the attendance for that show, the YouTube top highlights for that show, and things of that nature. We just had a merchandise update looking at daily collections of the items that are listed most highly on the various promotions merchandise stores. So that's all there. Patreon.com/WrestleNomics.
I am back tonight with Wei Ting. We will be live right after AEW Dynamite, and we will be chatting about additional news topics. We will run through Dynamite. If you want to get the XL edition of the show, which includes our discussion on all the news items and the Q&A session at the end of each show, that is available for members at postwrestlingcafe.com. Also dropping a show on Thursday, Rewind Away, where we are going to cover a playlist that has been put together covering Bret Hart's 1996 1997 run. So we
one of the greatest runs, in my opinion. I remember like getting like a VHS compilation of something like that of like the Raws from 97 and just being blown away as a, I don't know, probably late teenager or something.
Just going through, because so much of when people go back to this 97 period, so much of it centers around like Montreal and the end. But like this, this playlist we have, it's like 96 up until the Hart Foundation.
He's already talking about being screwed before the screw job happens.
I mean, Bret Hart was just like him and Sean. It was an incredible dynamic that they had on television. And you mix that in with Steve Austin at the time. Yeah. And it's a really intriguing period that I think you can always take elements from, is that the company was certainly rebounding and the television was so much improved as early as, you know, early to mid 97, but that did not bear fruit until a full year later. Like it is a kind of an instance in being able to have the faith that you are going down a direction that is going to yield results, but is not going to be overnight. And it's not until the spring of 98 and like the ascension of Steve Austin that really, you know, changes the fortunes for the company as well. But it's very, very evident in early 97, what they had. And also being able to do that in a year where they would lose Bret, they would lose Sean, they'd even lose Sid, who's like a top guy at that particular time. It's like their two biggest stars are gone and the company just skyrockets afterward.
And a very prescient commentary, topical today, when it comes to U.S.-Canada relations.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that will come up as well. So the 25% tariff, man, Bret the Hitman Hart will be covered on Rewind Away. And you know what? We're going to close on this because maybe we did bury the lead, because we got breaking news today from Tony Khan when speaking to TV Insider, not only on his thoughts on the show Dynasty with Joan Collins, but he has confirmed the first time that an AEW representative has actually stated that AEW Grand Slam will air after the NBA All-Star coverage, confirming his own network partner's TV scheduling grid. And wouldn't you know it, it was always supposed to be a TV event. And we're going to announce that 10 days out.
Having this be a TV event has always been the plan. That's something that the network wanted. It's something the network brought to us recently as an opportunity to follow the NBA All-Star.
Isn't that contradictory right there? It was always supposed to be a TV idea. That's something the network just brought to us.
Yes. It invites literary analysis, certainly.
Okay. So anyway, there you go. That's the Grand Slam show in Australia. We will have a post-wrestling correspondent at this show credentialed to cover it. Maybe we'll be joining us on an edition of Pollock and Thurston. We shall see.
Wow.
So there you have it. That's going to wrap things up. For Brandon Thurston, I am John Pollock. Thanks to everyone for tuning in live or listening to this on someone else's stream if they stole the audio. We appreciate all of you listeners.
Does that happen?
Speak with you. I don't know. It's a thing out there. Postwrestling.com, WrestleNomics.com. We are here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Goodbye.
A strong host game needs a strong wing game. Add Popeye's wings to your game day spread, and the crew won't just be cheering, they'll be salivating. With 8 bold, crispy Louisiana flavors to satisfy everyone's taste buds, our wing game is strong enough to always get you the W. At $5.99 for a 6-piece, order bone-in or boneless for your next watch party. Someone just wrapped up the title of Most Valuable Host.
Have that chicken from Popeye's.
At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary, tax extra.